From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. A senior North Korean official is reportedly on his way to the U.S. after stopping in Beijing, presumably to speak with U.S. officials ahead of a proposed U.S.-North Korea summit in Singapore. Kim Jong-chol has been closely involved with talks with South Korea. Monday, President Donald Trump and Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe spoke by phone, planning to hold face-to-face discussions ahead of that meeting between Mr. Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. International Strategic Studies Professor Yoichiro Sato at the Rimsumeikan Asia Pacific University said Mr. Abe wants an update on the proposed talks.
Japan has been strongly backing the U.S. stance on the CVID, complete, verifiable, irreversible disarmament of North Korea. For the U.S. to move from that means there's a great implication for Japan's standing, especially Japan's stance on presence of U.S. troops on the Korean Peninsula.
That face-to-face meeting between the Japanese and American leaders could come on the sidelines of the Group of Seven Economic Summit next month in Canada. The White House said both leaders affirmed the shared imperative of achieving the complete and permanent dismantlement of North Korea's weapons of mass destruction. Mali's president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, has announced he'll run for re-election in July. The 73-year-old Mr. Keita made the announcement on state television Monday. He'll be among a dozen other candidates, including opposition leader and former finance minister Sulemaya Cisse. Jihadist and ethnic violence has plagued the country and cast doubt on whether all sections could participate in elections that have been repeatedly postponed since 2013. This is VOA News. France is hosting a conference Tuesday seeking a political roadmap for Libya, a country that's been in chaos since the fall of dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Paris hopes to secure a collective agreement on elections by the end of the year. The International Crisis Group warned the meeting could be counterproductive. Anthony Billingsley is a Middle East lecturer at the University of New South Wales.
Some groups in Libya are being either bypassed entirely or treated to second-class roles in the process. And the other thing is the role of General Haftar, who is perhaps one of the biggest problems in the whole process, because he is central to the government in the east of the country.
Billingsley said Haftar is viewed suspiciously by some as a dictator in waiting. The conference will also involve Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj, head of the UN-backed Unity government in Tripoli. Snap elections in Italy are now expected later this year after President Sergio Mattarella appointed former International Monetary Fund official Carlo Cottarelli as interim prime minister. Massimo Franco is political correspondent for Convair della Sera newspaper.
They demonstrated that they couldn't form a government, or anyway, that they wanted to impose a candidate who was not in tune with our European agreements.
Mr. Mattarella Sunday vetoed Eurosceptic Paolo Savona as economy minister, a choice made by both the Five Star Movement and Northern League, who gained the most votes in last March's election. European Union foreign ministers met Monday in Brussels to find ways to preserve the Iran nuclear agreement now that the U.S. has pulled out. Belgian Foreign Minister Didier Reynders said it's important the EU prove it has the ability to seal such deals.
We try to go further with the JCPOA, first of all because it's a very clear commitment from the European Union and the entire international community. So it's very important to prove that we have the capacity to implement. So we will do that with the Iranian partners, not only on the public side, with the Central Bank, with the European Investment Bank, but we try also to promote the presence of SMEs in Iran, and we try also to promote the possibility for the very large companies to work in Iran.
The reimposition of U.S. sanctions following the U.S. pullout will penalize foreign firms doing business with Tehran. Palestinian militants in Gaza Tuesday fired a barrage of mortar shells into southern Israel. Most were intercepted by Israel's Iron Dome aerial defense system. No casualties have been reported. Several Palestinians have been killed in recent days in attempts to breach the border fence between Israel and Gaza. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has been released from a West Bank hospital after a stay of more than a week to treat a lung infection. The 82-year-old Abbas, who took over leadership in 2004, had earlier been hospitalized for ear surgery and was also being treated for pneumonia. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN says Central African Republic is descending into the abyss.
A quarter of the population in Central Africa are not in a position to have a normal life, are not in a position to send their kids to school, and not in a position to have access to their land.
Nigel Rushdie is the UN humanitarian coordinator in the Central African Republic. For the second time, former President Mugabe did not testify before Parliament about diamonds corruption. A court appearance today in Kenya for more than 50 people for allegedly stealing more than $100 million from the government. And today is Democracy Day in Nigeria, but the opposition says President Buhari is not qualified to speak on democracy.
Where in the world does a president take the permission of the opposition to address the nation? It is the right of a president to address the nation anytime on any subject he or she so wishes.
Lau Mohammed is Nigeria's information minister, and Malawi's vice president is concerned about what he says is the embarrassing levels of corruption in Malawi. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. United Nations reports the Central African Republic's five-year civil war is intensifying and has now spread to practically all parts of the country, even to those areas in northern and central African Republic that have been relatively stable. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations reports once safe areas, such as the capital Bangui and the Central African Republic's second city and commercial hub, Bambari, have become war zones. Aid agencies note the country's critical situation has dramatically worsened during the past year. They say an upsurge in violence has increased the number of internally displaced people by 70% to nearly 690,000 in less than a year. Refugee numbers also have gone up 25% to more than 575,000. UN humanitarian coordinator and CAR Najat Rushdie says an upsurge of violence in April and May has sent many returning refugees fleeing to neighboring Cameroon and Chad. She says one in four people in the country is now displaced.
Meaning that a quarter of the population in Central Africa are not in a position, actually, to have a normal life, are not in a position to send their kids to school, and not in a position to have access to their land, are not in a position even to participate to the rebuilding and reconstruction and the recovery of their own country.
Rushdie says more than half of the population, around 2.5 million people, needs humanitarian assistance. Unfortunately, she says, the United Nations is only able to provide them with a fraction of what they need because of a shortage of funds. She says the year is almost half over, and the United Nations has received only 15% of its $515 million appeal for 2018. She says this response is forcing UN agencies to drastically cut aid programs. For example, she says the World Food Program has been forced to cut food rations by two-thirds. The UN official is appealing to international donors to be more generous. She says humanitarian assistance in CAR's hotspots makes the difference between life and death. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Zimbabwe's parliament said Monday that former President Robert Mugabe faces jail time if he fails to appear before a committee that is investigating the alleged embezzlement of $15 billion in diamond revenues. Sebastian Mofu has more from Harare.
After waiting in vain for more than an hour for Mugabe to appear before the parliament's Mines and Energy Committee, committee chairman Themba Mliswa said lawmakers are running out of patience. This is the second time the 94-year-old former Zimbabwean leader has failed to show up for a committee hearing.
In the letter that we're writing to him, which is the final letter, we're also reminding him that we will be summoning him, and we're hoping that we don't get to that stage of summoning the former president. I hope this last letter to him will be something that he will appreciate that. And of course, you know that if he does not attend, there's then he'll be in contempt. And in being in contempt, there are many results. Let me remind you that the former and late Roy Bennett was sent to prison by Parliament. So let's always be mindful of the powers that Parliament has.
The committee is investigating alleged corruption in the country's diamond mining industry. In 2016, Mugabe said Zimbabwe had lost $15 billion from embezzlement. Diamonds were discovered in eastern Zimbabwe in 2006 and initially raised hopes that they would help turn around the country's ailing economy. But little diamond revenue found its way into the average citizen's pocket or the government's treasury. While Mugabe's government accused mining companies of not declaring their actual profits, Global Witness and other corruption watchdogs expressed concern over abuses and mismanagement in the diamond sector. Global Witness accused state security agencies and Mugabe's political allies of siphoning off the profits from diamond mining and of selling the precious stones themselves and keeping all the proceeds. Mugabe resigned in November 2017 after giving in to military-led pressure and has not been seen in public since then. He only addressed a few journalists earlier this year, accusing his former deputy and successor, President Emmerson Mnangagwa, of deposing him through a coup. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Zimbabwe's parliament says it has given former President Robert Mugabe a third chance to appear before the Mines Committee to face questions on the alleged disappearance of $15 billion in diamond revenues while Mr. Mugabe was in power. Human rights lawyer Mashobana Humbe says parliament no longer has the power to jail the former president like it did to the late Roy Bennett of the opposition movement for democratic change, who was involved in a scuffle in the House of Assembly with Finance Minister Patrick Chinamansa. Humbe tells Gabe Dube that the jailing of anyone deemed to be in contempt of parliament was scrapped following the adoption of a new constitution in 2013.
I think the best that they can do is to make a reprimand to the former president. Because you recall that, long back, what Parliament did is it convicted Bennett of the MTCT, who is late now, and sentenced him to a prison or custodial term. So it was felt during the constitutional making process that Parliament should not have such powers because they are likely to be abused where one of the parties enjoys the majority and then it seeks to use it to harass its opponents by sentencing them to custodial terms. So that power of sentencing someone to a custodial term can only be utilized by a court of law as defined. The courts of law are listed within the constitutional architecture of Zimbabwe. So I think what the best that Parliament can do is to issue a reprimand against Mr. Mugabe and perhaps warn them that in future they may want to fine him.
But can they actually fine him?
I've not checked, unfortunately. But I think they can actually issue a fine, and that fine is liable to be reviewed by a court if it has not been exercised properly.
So now, looking at the powers of Parliament, are you actually saying that they've been diluted or Parliament is now powerless in terms of punishing people?
Parliament is a law-making chamber. That's what Parliament should do primarily. This business of punishing people should be left to the courts. If they think that Robert Mugabe has got some information that they want, they should go to court and seek a court order to compel him to avail such information. Other than that, Parliament should focus on law-making and holding the executive to account. The country is, collapsed under their watch. So they should focus more of their energies on that.
So here, Mr. Ngobe, are you saying that apparently there's no section in the Constitution that gives Parliament, the right to actually charge people if somebody decides not to appear before a parliamentary committee?
That power never existed in our Constitution. It used to exist within the Parliamentary Privileges and Immunities Act. That is where it was derived. But within the new constitutional architecture, that power is inconsistent, so it cannot be utilized anymore. In the wake of what was done to Bennett, So that power is no longer there.
That was human rights lawyer Mashobana Mbe. He was speaking from Zimbabwe's second largest city, Bulawayo, with Gibbs Dube of VOA Zimbabwe Service. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, the 29th day of May. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 and a half minutes past the hour. In Kenya, more than 50 top officials will be arraigned in court today, Tuesday, for allegedly stealing more than $100 million from the Kenya National Youth Service. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the money was to be used to procure goods which were never delivered.
The suspects were arrested Monday, and according to Director of Public Prosecution Nurdin Haji, there is sufficient evidence to press charges against them. Among those to be arraigned Tuesday are Kenya National Youth Service Director Richard Ndubai and Public Service and Youth Secretary Lilian Omolo.
I am satisfied that the evidence is sufficient to warrant urgent prosecution and that it is in the public interest to charge the following. First of all, we have the category of the public servants, and we have one, Lilian Omolo, who was the Principal Secretary, Ministry of Public Service, Youth and Gender Affairs. Richard Ndubai, Director General, NYS. Sami Michuki, former Acting Director General, NYS. Nicholas O. Ahere, Senior Deputy Director, NYS.
Haji says the suspects will be charged with conspiracy to commit corruption, willful failure to comply with applicable procedures and guidelines on the management of public funds, fraudulent acquisition of public property, and fraudulent making payments from public revenues. He says the investigations were about $80 million pending bills paid by the public service secretary, Lilian Omolo.
The public servants will be charged with several offenses, including conspiracy to commit an offense of corruption, willful failure to comply with applicable procedures and guidelines relating to the management of public funds, a breach of trust by a person employed in the public service, willful neglect to perform official duty, abuse of office. My office is preparing to have the suspects arraigned in court to answer to the charges. In the first phase, investigations revealed that there was no procurement undertaken before monies were paid out. So there was no procurement whatsoever.
The process might see more companies and individuals put under probe and possibly prosecuted. At the same time, President Uhuru Kenyatta has condoned the act, citing that Kenya will not tolerate such.
We are no longer going to tolerate in our country unethical people. If you have been given responsibility, you need to understand that that responsibility is a responsibility to serve and not to be served. And ethics is not about being given positions of authority, but it is how they use that position of authority.
This is not the first time the National Youth Service has come under scrutiny fraudulent act. In 2016, then Devolution Cabinet Secretary Anne Waiguru was caught up in a scam whereby almost $8 million was lost and no one prosecuted. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Malawi Vice President Saulos Chilima has expressed concern about what he says is the embarrassing levels of corruption in the country. His comments came at a speech during a Roman Catholic Church event over the weekend, where he called on citizens to condemn those he said are stealing public funds. The vice president also said corruption is to blame for the ongoing drug shortages in hospitals across the country. Critics say the vice president's pronouncement is an admission that the administration of President Peter Mutharika has failed in its fight against corruption. For analysis, viewers Peter Clotte reached Sharif Kaisi, principal at the Skyway University in the commercial capital, Blantyre.
People have been saying almost every time and again that corruption is very rampant in the country. You cannot get free services unless you go that shortcut of doing the corruption. So by the vice president coming flat on Saturday and announcing and agreeing, I think it was just complimenting of what the state president said. Last year he did also agree that the country corruption is a violence that has almost eaten and disturbed all the public service rendering to the public. But unfortunately, he's working 70% government, and by coming up front to the public and announce that there is too much corruption, probably the question would be, what is his position as the vice president? What is his position, and what is he doing really to show that there is really corruption? Because you cannot say that the things are not okay, but we are still part of the government.
Some Malawians are of the opinion that this is quite ironic, because the government keeps telling Malawians that they are combating corruption and that corruption levels are not as high as they used to be in the previous Joyce Banda administration. So how do you reconcile the two?
When you look at the ground, you see we have the anti-corruption bureau. You'd see that there are a lot of cases which are non-concluded. For example, issues of former President Dr. Bakili Muluzi and many other issues, the issue of Kashgate itself and many other issues. We have the Maize Gate, which has just been concluded, not even concluded, but just acquitted that the former Minister of Agriculture, Dr. Chaponda, is no longer answering that charge. But you would agree with me that you can only say that things are okay when issues, for example, are taken to court and they are concluded and you see the ruling of the court. But this is not the case in our country. So many cases are in the court and are non-completed. And the issues of corruption is very rampant. I don't agree with that view which says that now cases are minimal and there are fewer cases of corruption. I think that is not true.
Some are also suggesting that the vice president made the statement because of a clandestine move to try to get rid of Peter Arthur Mutharika, so he could become the presidential candidate of the DPP in the next election.
Of course, to a certain extent, you would say yes, because now you see that since he was elected alongside the current president, after Peter Mutharika, it's now about 4 years in the government. And this issue of corruption is not a today issue, but is the issue that has been rocking the country for many years, as we have said. So by him today coming to say that there is too much corruption, then the question which we raise in many cases is that is it today that he has discovered that there is corruption in the country? Why not yesterday?
Sharif Kaisi is the principal at the Skyway University in Malawi. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from Blantyre. Nigerians are observing Democracy Day today, Tuesday, a day that marks the country's return to democratic rule in 1999 after 33 years of primarily military rule. Today also marks the end of President Muhammadu Buhari's third year as a democratically elected leader. The Nigerian Labour Congress says the 18 years of democracy have benefited the political class and not the average Nigerian, but it says democracy remains the best form of government. Main opposition People's Democratic Party, the PDP, says President Buhari has violated all tenets of democracy and therefore should not address the nation on Democracy Day. But Information Minister Lai Mohammed says the PDP has run out of ideas. He says President Buhari will address the nation to tout the many achievements his administration has made over the last 3 years.
The last statement by PDP, I think, has finally proving our point that the PDP is a party that's run out of ideas. And it's so sad that the PDP 16 years in government had no clue. And even in opposition, they still have no clue either. Where in the world does a president take the permission of the opposition to address the nation? It is the right of a president to address the nation anytime on any subject he or she so wishes. For God's sake, our achievements are out there for the whole world to see. Facts don't lie. We promise Nigerians that we are going to improve the economy. We promise them we are going to fight corruption. We promise them that we are going to fight insecurity. And I say with also the modesty that we have delivered on all those three promises. The facts are there. And we challenge them to controvert it.
Lyle, this is what the PDP is saying. They're accusing President Buhari, your administration, of violating all tenets of democracy. They ask the following questions. How can Nigerians celebrate Democracy Day when the rights of citizens are daily trampled and they no longer enjoy their freedom to politically associate and aspire? Where is democracy when government turns towards military fiat, where citizens are wantonly arrested? Where is democracy when opposition members have become endangered species and considered enemies of the state? So that's what they are saying.
You see, where in the world do you have immunity against stealing simply because you're in opposition? And we want the PDP to give us one example where we have trampled on the rights of any individual. When they were looking to treasury, they never knew that a day of reckoning like this would come.
all we have done so far is allow the law to take its course. Why are they suddenly afraid? So we can't arrest people because election is approaching. If they have stolen, it's border rush. Like I say again, this is a party that is run out of ideas. Let them come out and tell us that as anybody whom we have accused of stealing, have we locked them up? Are they not before court? Many of them still enjoy bail. So what is this for the accusation? You are alleged to have stolen, you are arrested, you are questioned, you are being prosecuted, and you don't say it's because elections are approaching. The Constitution says we can't arrest or prosecute you because elections are approaching. The government can arrest anybody who has run foul of the law at any time and anywhere. We have no apology for that.
Lau Mohammed is Nigeria's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. In the Gambia, police have arrested pro-environmental campaigners who staged a demonstration over the weekend against what they called environmental exploitation. The activists have accused the Gambian engineering firm of illegal sand mining, thereby endangering the environment. Pandere Umbai has the rest of the story.
Sand mining is a lucrative business venture in the Gambia, though environmentalists have frowned against the practice. They say it is causing more harm than good to the environment. Over the weekend, the villagers of Faraba Banta took to the streets to protest against a local sand mining company after accusing the company of environmental exploitation. Faraba is situated in southwestern Gambia. It is about 51 kilometers away from the capital city, Banjul. Landing Kinte is Gambia's Inspector General of Police.
With regards to the Faraba incident, some elements of the village development committee rallied some youth to protest against the local sand mining company. I think they did some destruction to some of the facilities that were put in place to work at the sand mines in Faraba, including the caterpillars that are supposed to pave away from the main road to the site where they are supposed to mine sand.
Environmentalists in Faraba have accused the police chief of siding with the business giant Julake, a charge vehemently denied by IGP Kinte.
My conscience is clear with regards to the actions that we've taken in trying to maintain the rule of law. Julake was duly issued with license to mine. We had a meeting including the Village Development Committee, the Council of Elders, the Alcalde of Faraba, and it was confirmed that Julake went through all the due process to be issued license, and he was issued license.
Julake was indeed issued a license to mine sand in Faraba. But Alhaji Sanyang, the chairman of the Village Development Committee, believes that the community ought to have been consulted first before issuing such a license. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandere Umbai reporting.
And briefly, before we leave you a summary of African news, Nigerians are observing Democracy Day today, Tuesday, a day that marks the country's return to democratic rule in 1999 after 33 years of primarily military rule. Today also marks the end of President Muhammadu Buhari's third year as a democratically elected leader. The Nigerian Labour Congress says the 18 years of democracy have benefited the political class and not the average Nigerian. Our information minister, Lau Mohammed, says the opposition PDP has run out of idea. He says President Buhari will address the nation to tout the many achievements of his administration that he has made over the last 3 years. And that's it for this Tuesday, May 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very productive day.
It's the weekend, and whatever you're doing, you could use a little extra love. Music love, that is. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa, and I've got the perfect weekend show for you.
I'm the king of the kuntu, and the love the way I do this uncle.
First, a 30-minute playlist of the continent's best music. Then, a live studio interview and music performance by Leni Stern Trio. Think award-winning female electric guitar player falls in love with West African griot music. Lots of love coming to you this weekend. Don't miss it on Music Time in Africa, Sunday and the following Saturday at 15 and 2000 UTC. Yeah!